Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel. With me tonight is Pierce Bauer.
What's up?
Here at the Mediocre Movie Club, we are a group of friends who typically we select three totally random movies. Maybe they're new releases, maybe they're not. Who knows? And we get together and we discuss them on our website, mediocremovie.club. And then at the end of the month, we discuss those three movies. But that's not what we're doing tonight. Tonight, in the vein of our David Fincher show podcast episode, where myself and Pierce ranked all of David Fincher's movies in celebration of the release of Mank, we didn't really celebrate Tenet, which was one of our previous selections here at the Mediocre Movie Club. But in honor of that, we're going to get together again to discuss our Christopher Nolan rankings, who just so happens to have made the same number of movies as David Fincher. Which, you know, makes for a nice little digestible episode. Pierce, before we start, in general, Christopher Nolan, what do you think?
Yeah, we talked about this in our last episode, our normal episode, where we talked about Tenet, mm-hmm. which is like, I genuinely really like Christopher Nolan movies. And for the most part, when I was looking back at kind of his career as a whole, I did come to realize, like, he really was maybe the premier director of my upbringing as like a film watcher, because like when I was a teenager was when he was coming out with most of his best work. And he really is a notable guy for being a blockbuster filmmaker. He does original stories for the most part, if not, you know, franchise IP that he still turns into his own thing within the kind of studio system. And I, for the most part, he usually delivers at least something watchable. So, like, I genuinely like his movies. And that's why when we talked about Tenet last week, that's one that I found frustrating, because for him, I have, like, a higher standard. So I really like him as a director. I think he really knows how to, like, put a set piece together, build tension. And the way things look in his movies are, like, genuinely cool, and better production and set design and costuming and all those things than your run-of-the-mill blockbuster. So for my, you know, top-tier Nolan, I really like those movies. They're rewatchables for me, and they're ones that I came up, you know, seeing in the theater and just, like, having my teenage mind blown. And then as the years have gone on, I think he's kind of hit or miss, but it will be fun to kind of look at his career as a whole and kind of see where he's at.
For my part, I have a great deal of admiration for him and essentially no love at all. I mentioned in our previous podcast that none of his movies has ever, for me, reached an A level. I agree with everything Pierce said about how he takes a lot of original stories. He's also big on the theater experience. He's big on filming in film instead of on digital. He's almost solely responsible for IMAX as a company. It's like him and museums as a whole. So, like, he is an important figure. It's encouraging that anybody in, like, this climate is allowed a nine-budget movie or a nine-figure budget movie to basically do whatever they want, success or failure. I mean, he's never really had a straight-up failure with the exception of Tenet, but that doesn't really count just because of extraneous circumstances. But I'm just not his demographic, I don't think, in general. He is able to, like, assemble some kind of, like, blockbuster-based awe and spectacle, but there's just always something about him that rubs me the wrong way. And we'll probably get into several instances of those kind of things as we go through his filmography. If you listen to our David Fincher podcast, you know our format here. Pierce is going to start at the very bottom. Christopher Nolan's made 11 movies, and we're not going to talk about each movie until we've both said it. So with that, Pierce, number 11, bottom of the Christopher Nolan filmography. What do you got?
So I'm going to say for number 11, not because it's necessarily his worst movie, but maybe the one that's just the outlier, really, is Following, which was his first film, just because it doesn't really get the full film treatment that his other movies get. It's more of a shorter film with limited budget, limited cast, limited set, all that stuff. So it's definitely, I think I would recommend it to somebody before maybe some of the picks that are going to follow here. But as far as total ranking goes, I guess this has to be last. even though there is a bit of interesting narrative kind of trickery going on, but overall it's ultimately you can skip it, but it's got a bit of an inkling of where he's going to go as a filmmaker for something that's pretty limited in scale and scope.
Following is an NA for me, so we'll go ahead and knock out all our discussion of it for now. I haven't seen it. Right. I didn't see it in advance of this. I guess the only thing I'm really curious about is if it foreshadows anything.
It definitely, yes. So he definitely does some trickery with characters' names and identities, and you don't know who this character is until later in the film, and then it explains some of their earlier actions. So he definitely touches some of that stuff early on, but like I said, it just doesn't have the kind of, you know, full theater experience that you kind of want from a Christopher Nolan movie.
Gotcha. And I would imagine that was like in the same way that Pi for Aronofsky is like a five-figure budget movie. I would imagine Following to be more or less the same.
It's if it's not single location, it's just about, and it's filmed black and white for, I believe, money reasons. And yeah, I don't think any actors in the movie are notable actors. So it's like a step above film school, maybe.
All right. Number 10, Pierce.
So for me, it's Insomnia.
Okay. My number 10 is Tenet.
Okay.
Pierce, number 9.
So my number 9 is actually Dark Knight Rises.
Okay. My number 9 is Insomnia. For me, this movie is just... It should be said that Pierce recently watched all of Christopher Nolan's movies in a week, right?
Yes, but actually, I never noted this before. I started rewatching Insomnia, and frankly, I did not even finish it, actually.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of how I remember this. Like, this is a movie that exists. It stars Al Pacino and Robin Williams and Hilary Swank, and that's kind of all I've got about it. Like, something of a cat and mouse. Cop serial killer in Alaska where the sun never sets, or somewhere far north. I don't know if it's Alaska or not. My memory of this is just extremely fuzzy. Like, it basically made no impression on me. I remember Al Pacino jumping across a lot of logs in a river. That's about all.
Yeah. This is a movie where when I was going to rewatch it, I kind of thought to myself, like, this is the one I'd maybe seen it once before. You know, on paper, this is like that plot description is the type of movie I should like. Like, I really like a good crime drama like that. But as I was watching it, there's not a lot of there. Like, it just does not grip you in any way. And I think, like you said, it comes at a weird time where I don't think Christopher Nolan totally had his, like, set of players together that kind of come through in his later films to kind of both, like, actors and cinematography and editing and set design. Like, all the things that and the people that come together to help make his films, I think is kind of missing in this one. This is where he kind of, as a filmmaker, I would imagine, Following probably was a pretty, like, indie hit, and then Insomnia was maybe a reach up the ladder, probably.
Sure, and, like, Memento is in between, so, like, this would be, like, a welcome to the big stage kind of movie.
Yes, you're right, I forgot.
Especially in the context of, like, the early 2000s when this would have been released, when you have a lot of these kind of movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, cop versus smart criminal, if Robin Williams is even that smart in that movie. Again, I barely remember this.
Right, and I think if Nolan was the filmmaker he is today with the sway he has, I'm guessing Pacino and Williams are not the actors he goes with, because they both were not great in that film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the bottom. Okay, so your number 8.
So my number 8 is Tenet.
Okay. Tenet... We are fresh off our conversation of that. That podcast was just published. Well, that doesn't mean anything. I have no idea when this episode is going to be published. In the time since we recorded that conversation, I listened to all of my film podcast lineup about Tenet, and it made me dislike it more. A lot of, like, the Blank Check podcast and Slash Film Cast and Film Spotting and Slate Spoiler Special, and I feel like there were a couple others too. They all had to make a lot of excuses for Tenet, and I just have no interest in any of that. I don't feel the need to make excuses for one of the most powerful directors in Hollywood. That the idea of it is a little offensive to me.
I think Tenet, to talk about the criticism or the response, like critical response to Tenet, like I think Tenet came out at a time when our grip on blockbuster movies was pretty loose, right? Because we like literally had not had really a movie come out like that for at least, you know, 6 months to a year. And I think a lot of people were just forgiving of,
yes,
forgiving, I guess is the right word, but just like, I think a lot of critics fell back on, if you go back and read reviews, so many people in their first paragraph reference the line, "Don't think about it, just feel," right? The line from Tenet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a crutch for maybe a lot of critics to say, like, yeah, this movie is not enjoyable as a kind of narrative, like as a plot that you're following. And it's not maybe enjoyable necessarily in understanding the science or logic, but it is still just like big blockbuster action. And for me, like what I really think is the failure of this movie is that those action sequences are just nonsense and not in a good way. Like, I think there are other films in his career that are better examples of that, of I don't give a shit if the science checks out or if the plot totally makes sense, but what I'm watching on screen is awesome. For me, I just did not feel that with Tenet. It was kind of, it made me kind of question, and not like too deeply, but genuinely as I was watching it, it made me question like my literacy as a film watcher of like, why aren't I getting this? Why don't I understand which car is chasing the other car and why? Like, it really never made sense. And so I think that's the biggest sin with Tenet, is just that like that final set piece, that with the two military, you know, the temporal
pincer. Sure, temporal pincer move.
Ugh. That is such an, just a utter failure of a scene in my book. I just do not know who would watch that scene and not only like understand like the stakes and the mission of like, what are they actually trying to do and who are they fighting against and who is that guy in that mask and who is that guy in the other mask? Like, that already is confusing, but just as you're watching it, there's nothing on screen that is visually capturing. It is a mess of just bodies and gunfire and explosions, and none of it is compelling. So that for me is really what Tenet failed at. And for me as a movie, like, that's kind of what I like best in a Nolan movie. Like I said, there'll be later picks down the line that I think just way, way more established, like fun, dumb action. Whereas Tenet was trying, I don't know what it was trying to do, but it did not accomplish that.
Yeah. I mean, thinking back, my favorite scene in that movie was, it was either John David Washington's fight in the kitchen with a cheese grater or the bungee jumping up a building. Neither of which scene requires any special timey-wimey stuff.
Right.
And the timey, and none of the time travel, reverse entropy, whatever bullshit, not a single moment of it interested me, entertained me, or made sense to me.
Right.
And I think the movie doesn't exist without the latter.
Yeah.
Which I is think frustrating, it's because just make the badass spy movie without all the extra bullshit.
Definitely. I think a good exemplar scene of that is like when John David Washington is fighting himself in reverse, right? Like, mm-hmm. on paper, that should be awesome. Both like as a kind of narrative twist, and the filmmaking style is a twist, and the fight scene should be fun. But really, when you're watching that scene, it's okay. It's okay. It's not great. And I think the comparison would be, think about the hallway scene in Inception,
yeah,
with Joseph Gordon-Levitt and the tumbling, you know, hallway. That is an example of, you know, using some sci-fi narrative twist to like up an action sequence versus what we get in Tenet is not that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Honest trailers, and I'm not crazy about these kind of YouTube channels that like pick films apart at like a plot A to B level. I think honest trailers is generally pretty good. That being said, they destroyed that scene for me. They just they pulled out a tiny segment that looked like it could have been a child shadow boxing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I can't think about that scene without thinking of Honest Trailers just eviscerating, yeah. eviscerating the fight choreography.
Yeah,
And this will come up with Nolan, and this is to like bring it back to like his directorial style. Like, there's things he's just always been bad at, and he has demonstrated no inclination or ability to improve them. And hand-to-hand combat. Mm. Both the choreography and the filming of it is something he has never been able to figure out.
Mm-hmm. I think there's decent examples in his work, and then there's ones that don't work as well. In the same vein of just like, as we go through these movies, just a thing that I have, like on an Honest Trailers level, like a frustration about with his, that he does multiple times in movies. And this is the first instance I'll point out, is he really loves what I refer to as kind of like the magic trick, which is that in the first act of the movie, he shows you something that you don't totally understand, and then he takes it away. And then in the final act of the movie, that thing comes back, and it's like a twist you didn't realize. Mm-hmm. He does that twice here in Tenet. I think both are bad, which is in the opening scene when the masked man saves John David Washington, and he sees the, like, you know, emblem on his backpack.
Mm-hmm.
And we're supposed to go, who was that guy? And then he disappears for this movie. And then the end, it's revealed who that guy was, right? He doesn't
really be one person.
Right, exactly. There's not many characters in this movie. And again, it was, I'll point it out, there's a more egregious one that comes up in another film, but he does this also with is it Elizabeth Debicki? Is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
Right, when she tells her story of seeing her husband cheat.
Yeah.
Woman diving off the boat. How are you not sitting there during that movie going, what the fuck are you talking? Like, why are you telling me about this woman diving off the boat if it's obviously not going to be, you know, a time loop thing? Like, it's just...
Sure, yeah.
He loves to do this, and I'll point out the most egregious one when we get there, but it's, I just want to put a pin in that as a trend that I see throughout his films. If he loves to show you something early, never, you know, don't talk about it till, and then bring it back at the last scene as a twist, and It drives me crazy sometimes with him.
Tenet and Insomnia, those two are ticked off. My number 8 is Interstellar. Pierce, your number 7.
My number 7 is Batman Begins.
Okay. My number 7 is Dark Knight Rises. So okay. Why don't you kick this one off?
Yeah. So I had this at number 9. So I had this below Tenet, which is...
Wild. That's wild.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. If you rewatch Dark Knight Rises, I think... when it came to like a head-to-head matchup of those two movies, I think I would rather rewatch Tenet on like a technical level than, because I think we forget, Dark Knight Rises is like 3 hours long.
Sure, yes, yes, and, that is true.
And like I said, I have some leeway with like dumb action movie plot, but Dark Knight Rises is kind of the worst of it. Like, it's pretty bad plot. I think Tom Hardy, I do like his Bane, like, that is a fun performance, but as far as the plot of the movie goes, like, it is not that interesting. It is not an interesting villain. There's a couple action sequences, like that opening scene in IMAX, I recall, with the plane, you know, dropping out, like, that's mm-hmm. great. Like, that's really good. I don't think the movie ever gets anywhere close to that at any other point in the film. So it's a pretty grueling rewatch, frankly. I think Anne Hathaway's pretty dull. I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt's pretty dull. And as a Batman film, it's not really the best Batman. So for me, I think I would not want to rewatch Dark Knight Rises, except for to laugh at some parts of it, because there are some, like, frankly, funny failures in that movie. But for Tenet, I guess I would rather rewatch that. So that's why I put it there at 8-9, but it easily could be swapped, you know. But I'm not the biggest Dark Knight Rises fan, but, you know, it's got some scenes to it. It's a Batman movie still, so there's some stuff to watch, but it is crazy how long that movie is. That's the biggest fault, does not need to be that long.
I'm not a huge fan of Dark Knight Rises either. This was number 7, but we're still pretty comfortably in the deep seas range. There are chunks of it that I have a lot of appreciation for. I do like Anne Hathaway a lot in this movie.
Mm.
I think she's probably the best part of it, even, I would say.
Mm.
I would also, I would agree that Joseph Gordon-Levitt is totally unnecessary. And, like, the second I saw the ending of this movie where he, like, discovers the Batcave,
yes,
my first thought was, like, and he was found beaten to death in the streets a week later. Like, Bruce Wayne was a trained ninja, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a random cop who's going to, like, jump in the Batmobile and try and beat up hoodlums. Like, it's going to go badly.
Well, you know, the movie supposes that cops are some type of lethal hand-to-hand combat fighting force.
Sure, yeah.
The sequence where
Chicago facsimile, where they have don't have like cirrhosis of the liver and they need like, a box of donuts a day.
300 cops just sprint out of being buried underground for weeks, months, I don't know.
Yeah.
And just fight a militia of who knows what country they're from. So what this movie thinks about the strength of an everyday policeman, who's to say?
Yeah, that's all fair. It's quite silly. The Bane stuff, I like how that voice, in spite of pretty much everybody agreeing that it's just the craziest choice, has persisted in the culture in like a Borat way. Like, people still do the Bane voice. And that doesn't bother me, because it is, like, the Borat stuff I feel like is admiring, whereas the Bane impression is like poking fun. So I just have more patience for it as something that's persisted. I like Marion Cotillard generally in everything.
She's again a kind of a, like, the whole movie you're kind of sitting there going, wait, so who is this character? And then at the end it's like, oh, it was just so that they could reveal she was someone else, you know?
Sure, but, yeah.
Yeah, I do think with Tom Hardy, I will say, as far as, like, comic book villains go, like, obviously there's a much better one on this list we'll talk about. But, like, compared to most Marvel movies, I could not tell you who the villain was. And, like, you know, at least Tom Hardy, like, makes a choice here.
Yes,
and
very much so.
And I kind of respect that more than, like, Josh Brolin as Thanos is, like, kind of boring, if you ask me. So, like, yeah. I do like that. I just kind of think in the, you know, not to spoil anything, I really like The Dark Knight. And I think coming off of that movie, it's just a worse Batman movie. And so it's tough to enjoy it as much when it's like, you know, you just watch a better version of this.
Yeah. And the general unpleasant, this was the first Nolan movie where I couldn't make out the sound or the dialogue a lot of the time. So kind of the start of a bad trend there for Nolan. I really wish maybe he's given an interview somewhere where he explains that tendency. What I suspect is that, well, theaters should have better sound systems is what he would say, which is kind of a ridiculous demand.
Yeah.
Maybe your movies are just mixed badly. But the other thing I'll say in slight favor of The Dark Knight Rises is it kind of has like an unfortunate asterisk next to it, just because this was probably not the plan to make pretty much a direct sequel of the first movie and mostly ignoring that the second movie happened.
Yes.
It is the unfortunate, you know, truth of Heath Ledger dying. Like, yeah. If I remember from some, like, 2008 or 2009 interview or like film insider type thing, it would have been like the third film would have also centered around the Joker.
Yeah.
Doesn't die at the end of The Dark Knight when he very easily could have. Mm-hmm. And then frankly, I'm surprised they didn't reshoot it to where he did. Because at least in the headcanon of The Dark Knight Rises, like, he's still alive and around somewhere, but here nor there.
I agree with you, though. It does it does feel kind of like a bit of a scramble.
Yeah. And
it's very much more tied to that first Batman Begins, which for me as a Batman fan, like, I'm more into Detective Batman than I am, like, Ninja Batman.
Sure.
League of Shadows stuff. So there is a bit of that disconnect. Yeah.
Okay. You're number six.
So at six, I have Interstellar.
Okay. Interstellar. Of all the movies in Nolan's filmography, this is the one that deserves a rewatch from me. This was my number eight. When I saw this movie in the theater, and we might just go ahead and blame Nolan for this, for over-mixing or just fucking with theater speakers, who knows. But with like 25 minutes to go, I want to say, after right at the point when Matt Damon is like blowing himself up, the sound went all crackly to the point it took me like 5 minutes to realize this wasn't supposed to be happening.
Yeah.
And it just persisted to the rest of the movie. And when I like tried to complain at the very end, there was just nobody in the theater. Like if the concession stand was open, it could have been looted. And the people that I saw Interstellar with were seriously considering it because we were so pissed off that we had to sit through like half an hour of this crackly sound. So that's, you know, on the theater, that's not an Interstellar. But up to that point, I would say this was the movie that has the most emotionally effective moment in a Nolan movie for me, but also totally indicative of all the stuff that irritates me about him as well.
Yeah.
But it's that one moment wasn't enough to totally turn me around on him.
And that one moment, just to be clear, is when Anne Hathaway gives the speech about love being a constant.
Yeah, if anybody's been listening to the Media Movie Club over the years, they know that I'm pretty much always quoting that speech. And I've got a Pam Puvy from Archer style tattoo of it all up and down my back. No, the moment is Matthew McConaughey returning from the time-dilated planet and realizing that like 20 years have gone by on Earth. Yes. He's like watching his children age in front of him. And this was at like peak McConaissance before it totally crumbled. He was like probably a year or two away from that at this point in 2014. And one of the better things he's ever done, I would say, as like big and large and emotive as that moment is.
Yeah, I was either a junior or senior in high school when this movie came out. I took my girlfriend at the time on a date to see it. And I remember like leaving the theater and both of us talking about like, wow, Matthew McConaughey is the best actor. Like you're right. That scene is great. I would say for Interstellar, this is one that upon rewatch kind of probably upped the rankings a bit for me. I think it's in his career, from what I recall, it's probably where the divisiveness started, you know, because it certainly is like maybe his most kind of like dorm room, you know, science-y, you know, endeavor that some people, frankly, some dumb people really like. And I think smarter people kind of stay away from. That's just me. But I think it does, when you rewatch it, you do see there is this like, there's this balance between like, it really is a technical marvel. Like some of the sequences he shoots are just awesome. Like I cannot deny it. But then on the other side of the scale is just like some really dumb fucking plot stuff that is like way not heady in like a over my head way, but heady in like a, you just took a bong rip in a dorm room futon and you're trying to explain black holes to me. And like, it really just doesn't work in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So like, I think upon rewatch, like it, there are sequences like when the docking sequence with the spiral and the camera movement is amazing. And the sequence you talked about where McConaughey, where it's just like an uninterrupted, you know, 4 minute shot of him crying. That's great. Mm-hmm. But for each one of those sequences, you also get like, you know, Anne Hathaway talking about love. Yes,
that speech is just execrable. Like how dare you put that in this movie?
Yes. And then, so like when I was talking before about how Nolan loves to do the first act introduction magic trick twist at the end of the movie, the bookcase shit, when you rewatch it, it is really insane to think like that an adult wrote that into this movie. Like not that a character goes into a bookcase and like, you know, changes gravity or whatever. Like that's part of science fiction. But when you watch this movie and the first act, you have what is like a pretty good setup. Like I think their depiction of Earth in this like kind of climate change future is like pretty, you know, it's a pretty good setup. And then for some reason, just inexplicably, the movie takes this turn where the little girl starts talking about a ghost in her bookcase and everyone just goes, okay, let's keep moving on. And then they're like, the movie just keeps going. How can you not sit there and just yell at your screen? Like, what the fuck was that about? And then when he brings it back in the final, you know, act of the movie, you're going, well, of course, like, what else? Like, why was that in the movie if it wasn't going to be like, it's just so poorly written on like a plot construction level. And it's just bad. Like, it's really, that's the most egregious part of the movie to me, is just how stupid that setup and quote unquote twist is. But like I said, the rest of the movie does have some really great, you know, cinematography, direction, and just great, you know, building of tension and delivering on those set pieces. So it's a 50-50 movie for me.
There's a growing contingent of people that really appreciate Interstellar as one of the better Christopher Nolan movies. Maybe on a rewatch I could get there. I think about this movie in comparison to something like Sunshine, which is just totally technical and de-romanticized and is like an exponentially better movie. That doesn't lose any emotional power despite not having something like Anne Hathaway's speech or these extremely corny and elemental like father-daughter relationships. Something that, to their credit, all of these podcasters that that were overly generous to Tenet, to all of their credit, to a show, they all brought up the line in Tenet where John David Washington was like, if they succeed, everybody will die. And Elizabeth Debicki is like, including my son. Like, no shit. Of course your son is included. Nolan, he keeps doing the same thing over and over again where, like, so much of his stakes have to be boiled down to, like, parent-child or husband-wife. I can understand that the stakes are, like, species level. That's enough. When he goes to the extra level, he's just not great at creating these, like, credible relationships.
Yeah. It's a running problem in his in the writing of the movies he directs. And we haven't mentioned yet. I think we're probably about to go on a run of dead wife trope.
Yeah.
One that falls, same thing, where it's like a really overused and oversimplified kind of plot device to make us care when in reality it doesn't. But, you know, it's Interstellar. I think what I always come back to with Nolan, and I believe he said this much in interviews, is that one of his biggest influences, of course, is Stanley Kubrick, right? And this is clearly, there's some ties to 2001 Space Odyssey. On like a really surface level, though.
In like the scientific rigor area, I think, yes.
But even just the last sequence of McConaughey in the bookcase is very purposefully filmed and looks like when, at the end of 2001, when he's going to the tunnel and talking to the robot while he's doing, you know, there's a lot there. But I always say with Nolan, he's better when he's just trying to do Spielberg than he is trying to do Kubrick. Because Stanley Kubrick would never explain what's happening at the end of 2001. Mm-hmm. In Interstellar, the entire time he is in that bookcase, the robot is explaining to him and the audience what is going on. And I think that's the key difference, which is like Kubrick is presenting you ideas in a format where you have to decipher it through the filmmaking. And Nolan does not do that at all in the way that, you know, someone like Stanley Kubrick does. So I like him more for the spectacle and just the, you know, set piece filmmaking. And so that side of him, that side of this movie works. The big brainy ideas really don't.
Yeah. Him's trying to split the difference between like Kubrick's iciness and Spielberg's like warm glow nostalgia type stuff. He can't do it. He has no utility creating those kind of like the McConaughey moment. That's a combination of an idea and a performance. And kudos to Christopher Nolan for having the idea, but it's McConaughey that's doing the bulk of the work there.
Mm-hmm.
So some amount of credit there, but not all to him. Yeah. Maybe like 25%.
And I'd throw in the score of the movie, which is a thing.
Sure. Yeah.
His movies have really great scores usually, and this Interstellar is a good example of that.
Yeah. My number six is Batman Begins. I think this is 2/3 of a really of one of the better superhero movies, and 1/3 of a totally generic and boring superhero movie.
Yeah. It by the end of the that last third of the movie feels like an early 2000s superhero movie in the worst way, right? If you rewatch like Spider-Man or the early X-Men and this, they all really feel dated. And the first 2/3 are pretty good. Yeah, that last third is tough.
I don't have a tremendous amount to say about Batman Begins. as far as origin stories go, I think like it's a different kind of tone that doesn't really get revisited. Even like with Zack Snyder and like Man of Steel, it's still not as bleak as this, mm-hmm. where like Bruce Wayne is about to like kill a convict and is just barely prevented from doing so, and like in turn throwing his entire life away. That combined with like the really strong and pretty thrilling like training sequences, some of the better versions of those. Mm-hmm. I really like Tom Wilkinson in this movie. Christian Bale hasn't fully leaned into his Batman voice yet, which I think is great and correct. The best version of the Batman voice that I think he ever does is when he's like whispering to one of the goons, like he's right behind him. That's still one of my favorite Batman moments in this like Dark Knight trilogy of Nolan's. But yeah, it's just that city destroying gonzo. We're going to poison the water supply, and we can only be saved by destroying this train.
I think sometimes people like to say this is actually the best Batman movie, which I wouldn't really agree with. I think Dark Knight comes along and just totally trumps this in anyone's memory, right? So, like, what you're saying, like, no one really revisits this one, because, again, the Dark Knight just does it better. And I think a really key difference that you can see between the first and second movie there is, like, the way he films and presents Gotham City in Batman Begins feels pretty fictional. And in Dark Knight, I think one of the best choices he makes is it's a real city. It feels like a real city. This is just a drama happening in essentially Chicago, you know. And I think that Batman Begins feels more like the Burton or even Shoemaker versions of Gotham. And so it just doesn't click. And like that last act with the poisoning the water and the fear gas stuff, it that's, again, in retrospect, like, you know, 15 years later or whatever, mm-hmm. it just doesn't click, you know, whereas The Dark Knight still does, visually at least, and you know, things like that.
With the fear stuff, I will say Cillian Murphy is like, as a constant part of Nolan's like stable of actors, is very good here. And like the idea of the Scarecrow and how it's represented, and like the hallucinogenic quality of all that is another very strong part of this movie that kind of goes away in the third act.
Yeah, that's a little more the comic booky, especially the way, if you rewatch it, like he really goes from like, hey, I'm just I forget what it is. He has a crazy job, which is like, you know, assessing the sanity of criminals, I guess, was his job. And mm-hmm. he really, from like, I'm an everyday working man, you know, or at least we're supposed to believe that, to like, he's in a, you know, a meeting and he pulls out the Scarecrow mask. And it's like, oh, wow. Like it really crosses this like uncanny valley almost of like, this was kind of believable. And now it's kind of comic booky in a bad way. But
sure. And like, he doesn't actually need this like burlap sack mask, because he's injecting people with like this fear gas. Whatever he looks like, they're going to be freaked out by.
Yeah, it's
so,
yeah.
That's fair.
It's a remnant of, again, like earlier superhero movies. Like, I think if after, you know, they were taken a bit more seriously and prestigious, which is like, this is kind of on the cusp of that. I think that character probably gets handled better. But yeah, it's not great. But he's, you know, like you said, Cillian Murphy, always welcome in my book.
Your number five, Pierce.
So my number five is The Prestige.
Okay, we'll come back to that one. My number five is Memento. Your number four.
Memento is my four, so perfect.
Okay. This is just a puzzle movie, and I'm not a huge fan of puzzle movies. It's pretty much as simple as that. That said, it is number five on my list. Guy Pearce as the lead in this is very good. I don't especially care to like do the backwards watching of Memento ever. But this movie probably contains the funniest joke that's ever been in a Nolan movie, who is not a funny director in any way, shape, or form, with Pierce's character, who, you know, has this 5 minute, whatever it is, amnesia, retrograde amnesia. And, he thinks he's chasing somebody, and it turns out whatever. I don't need to explain the joke. And I also think, Carrie Ann Moss in this movie is one of the three or four or five best performances in a Nolan movie as well, from an actor who has has had nowhere near the career that she should have had. Yeah. So, like, on the strength of those several things, there's enough going on in this movie that, I don't know, maybe I just don't want to think about plot mechanics too much. Maybe that's what I'm learning about myself, especially as I get older.
Mm-hmm.
There's enough scene to scene in this movie to where, like, the device isn't hampering it.
You nailed it, I think, which is, like, this is a puzzle movie. And similarly, like, that's really not my bag, you know? Mm-hmm. It certainly goes in the pantheon of, like, film bro explaining to a girl at a party the plot.
Yeah.
You know? But that being said, you know, as much as I don't like puzzle movies, I think this is a successful, you know, execution of it. Like, I really think it actually does work as a viewing experience, the way he deconstructs narrative. I like, upon rewatch, and I've seen this multiple times, the first time you watch it, I do think is kind of a pretty great experience, at least when I watched it. It was kind of one of those movies that, like, when you're, for me at least, like, when you're a teenager and the first time you hear about it and you just hear the kind of tagline of, like, you know, it's a movie told in reverse because the guy has amnesia, you go, I got to check that out. And I think it delivers. You know, I would not rewatch this movie yearly because I don't think it holds up in that sense. But, like, it'd probably been, you know, 5 to 10 years since the last time I watched it. So I rewatched it. And, you know, it's worth, if you forget what happens at the end or beginning, whichever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
Then rewatch this movie because you'll enjoy it by the time you get to the end. But if you've just seen it, like, it's not great for multiple watches in, like, a short span of time. But I do really like, what I liked about it watching it this time is I do think it is a purposeful kind of trick that he is pulling, right? This deconstructed narrative told in reverse with the guy with amnesia. I think it works in the kind of noir crime drama genre because mm-hmm. it is this story about, you know, a character not being able to trust the people around him and his surroundings. And the way that his amnesia works, I think, actually really benefits that type of story. You know, normally we get that type of, like, PI, you know, detective crime drama. And those are, you know, those are tropes within the story. But the, like you're saying, the scenes with Carrie Ann Moss, where you don't know how she's playing him or if they just spoke and she left, you know, it all does really work. And I think, especially the ending with Joey Pants,
mm-hmm.
I like it. I think it does work. If no one's ever seen this movie, and I hope I didn't spoil anything, I guess, but, like, if you've never seen it and you don't know the kind of conceit of what's going on, I can only imagine it's an enjoyable watch because it was for me when I first saw it.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. Like, you mentioned a little bit ago, like, the idea of rewatching Tenet being, like, tolerable. And I hope that I never have to think about that movie ever again because it's a painful experience for me. And that just wasn't the case with Memento. Like, this is, I think, a good amount of... If a director has to do this kind of thing, which, again, is not my favorite, I think this is, like, the appropriate amount to put in a movie. I also think, like, this is just, like, such a perfect second feature for, like, an up-and-coming director where it's going to create a lot of buzz and it's going to keep people talking and it, like, requires a level of rewatchability if you, like, fully want to understand it. And it creates this cult following of people who really want to interpret every little episode within the script.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as far as, like, a career path, it is very interesting. And, yeah. And, like, key to his mystique that this was his second movie instead of something like Insomnia, which is very much a for-hire movie.
Mm-hmm. And the last thing I would say, too, is he has a couple movies in the canon here where he tries to pull off the ambiguous ending. And I think Memento is actually probably his best, the way it ends with the uncertainty about what is the truth, which is the whole theme of the movie, you know,
who mm-hmm.
I actually think it's successful in that. Whereas his other attempts at that, I don't really know if he ever does that as well. So that's a real plus for me. So I actually, upon rewatch, this and Interstellar were the two biggest bumps for me.
All right. My number four is The Prestige. So I'll let you kick this one off.
Yeah, I think this is one, I believe, I want to give credit actually, because I think it's a great idea about this movie. I think Adam Neiman, the film critic, said that you can tell the most about Christopher Nolan from this movie, that this is kind of his most personal movie. And I think that's spot on when I was rewatching it. It is a movie about, like, entertainers and tricksters and, you know, these showmen and the idea of, like, innovation and sacrifice and ambition. And that is, like, what Christopher Nolan's whole career is kind of, as we've talked, right? You can certainly see that in these movies. I think it's a really good movie for what it is, which is a movie about two magicians trying to kill each other, which is a crazy dumb sentence, right? Like, you really have to buy in to the idea of, like, the lives of magicians and the you know, drama surrounding this rivalry. It's really goofy on paper, but as you watch it, his direction, the set design, the production, it's all really great. So it's a very good execution of what is maybe a kind of dumb movie in a worse filmmaker's hands. I think it delivers for the most part, but another thing that I feel like Nolan gets trapped into too often is he usually goes like one twist too far.
And yes, I think 100% with this movie.
Okay, great. So I think the final reveal of Christian Bale and the twin brother, you know, I think that's an excellent, great piece of plot within the movie. I think that's a good plot twist. It makes sense throughout the movie. The breadcrumbs are laid perfectly. Awesome. And then for no real reason, you know, no reason, we also then pan and see that Hugh Jackman has been cloning himself.
Yeah.
And that is insane. And that is just no place for that in this movie. And it's just one stretch too far. It's, again, it's an attempt at this kind of ambiguous, make you think end of, like, final nail in the coffin. And it just totally detracts the entire movie. That is a real sour note to end on for me. Whereas I think the rest of the movie, you know, magician, you know, take or leave the lives of magicians, it's a pretty good movie, all things considered.
Yeah, I like you mentioned, like, the setting and the like the plot and the production design and all that. I love all that stuff. I love the idea of these, like, turn of the century entertainers, like, battling for the ticket space and the auditorium space and what's going to break through and like these forms of mass media haven't developed yet, but places are getting more and more concentrated with more and more disposable income and they got to spend it somewhere. And it's like, I love that whole milieu and all that stuff is great. The magic angle, like, a lot of my current, as strange as this is to say, like, magicians in their own way were like the key to a lot of how I currently view the world. Like, the whole movement of, like, scientific skepticism comes from magicians like James Randi and Penn and Teller. The point being, like, I have a lot of respect for these, like, debunking magicians who, like, take it very personally when people, like, enter the public sphere and are like, I can actually do magic. Whereas magicians like Penn and Teller, like, their refrain, and I've never seen their show in Vegas, but my sense of it is that the theme of their Vegas show and their general act is that if you actually knew how these tricks were done, you would think you were a complete moron, because it's always the most, it's so unimpressive how they do these tricks. And I don't have a specific example outside of The Prestige, which I think is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Like, the actual method of their performances is the corniest, most obvious shit. Mm-hmm. And they're just good performers that are able to fool you into literally looking somewhere else. Mm-hmm. While they're just doing a thing. And here, the reveal of the twin is exactly correct. Mm-hmm. Both on we are artists and we take this so seriously, we're like, one of us is just going to give his life up. Mm-hmm. And on that Penn and Teller level of, like, no, it's just, there's, you think there's two of us? Well, in fact, there actually are. It's just as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And much like with Batman Begins, where I'm with it and I'm not with it, just the introduction of actual magic into the movie is so disappointing.
Yeah. It's like, again, like, that's the type of, a big criticism of Nolan, I think, is that he usually needs a kind of, like, second draft kind of like editor to come in and just like reel him back a little. And mm-hmm. this is probably one of the bigger instances of that for me, which is just like, yeah, if you just take one step back and you do not go even, don't even touch that idea of real magic, because that's idiotic, or, you know, it's mm-hmm. idiotic. So it's just, yeah, it's a real misstep for a pretty good movie. Like you said, like this idea, like I think this does have some thematic ideas to it that work about, you know, again, the commitment to art or the skepticism of what you're seeing in front of you, right? Like
maybe it was David Lynch who I was like reading an interview of, but like all, and he does, and this is what like all of Mulholland Drive is about to me mm-hmm. with David Lynch, like. Movies are just lies. Movies yes. are magic tricks.
Yes, the artifice.
You're sitting in a theater. You know you're not in this place, but a good movie can make you feel like you are, and like you are actually, your life is actually in danger, or you're actually feeling whatever the characters are feeling. Like it is a magic trick. So a movie about magicians is perfect for someone who incorporates the act of filmmaking into his movies as much as Christopher Nolan is.
I talked about kind of the way Nolan, he's clearly a magic fan, right? Not just because he made this movie, but the way he tries to construct twists in his other movies, right? Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, the way Michael Caine explains the Prestige, the magic trick, is exactly what Nolan does with twists in his movies. He shows it to you, takes it away, and then makes it reappear at the end in like a way you didn't expect. Mm-hmm. And he does that time and again, and sometimes it works. The twin reveal is the best example. But like in Interstellar, Tenet, you know, a couple other twists here at the end that we'll talk about. But like, it's very apparent about who he is as a filmmaker and who he thinks he is as a filmmaker.
Yeah. And his whole aesthetic, too, with like always wearing a suit everywhere and mm-hmm. being hard to reach. Like, I feel like in his heart, he is like a turn of the century pre-Lumiere Brothers entertainer, mm-hmm. like who would take up a street corner or a big auditorium if he was able to generate the publicity. I really think he identifies very strongly with like the two protagonists in this movie. Yeah. Your number three, Pierce.
My number three, talk about some good suits, is Inception.
All right. My number three is also Inception.
All right.
The movie this is most similar, I think, is to Tenet. As far as Nolan's filmography goes, just this dense concept, a huge amount of exposition, but the execution of the concept is just so much better in Inception. Mm-hmm. The stakes are recognizable. There's not really any villain. It's just a question of, like, can we accomplish this task? Can we pull off this heist? Mm-hmm. And I think people would disagree when I say it doesn't go too far. You might yourself disagree. Like there's like one dream level too deep, perhaps. But I find this like a very satisfying movie, and one of the better movies about making movies for the broad. I generally don't have a problem with those. Like, give me The Player. Like, Robert Altman's The Player any day of the week. That's a good movie. And many, many others of like movies about making movies. This is like the most palatable example of that kind of thing. And also a really naked metaphor where like you got your writer and your actor and your production designer and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I've heard that kind of meta reading of the roles, right? It's pretty apparent, sure.
Yeah.
Not really my approach to this movie, although like I have no qualms with that idea. I like this movie really as just a dumb blockbuster heist movie. Like, I think it delivers on that level. In the way, like you said, Tenet does not deliver as a spy thriller. That is, it doesn't actually take those steps, right? Whereas Inception, I do think, works on the, like, very elemental level of, like, this is a heist. We're giving it to you with a cool sci-fi twist. And, you know, I think an easy knock on the movie, and frankly correct, is like the first half of this movie is just setting up the dominoes and mm-hmm. showing you the rules and things like that. And then the second half is just like watching him get knocked down. But I have no problem with that. Like, I kind of wish, again, like I wish he would lean more into that type of not necessarily like simplicity, but just like, I don't know, weightlessness. Like, I don't think every scene needs to be so convoluted. And I think Inception does a good job of kind of being just like unrestricted in that way. So I like it. And again, like, this is, we'll talk about another one here, but like, this is one of my best movie theater experiences. Like, I just remember being on the edge of my fucking seat the entire, you know, second half of the movie. There's some great set pieces. I think really once they enter the heist, I think the whole movie just cruises. Like, it really is watchable. But specifically, like, the hallway fight scene with Joseph Gordon-Levitt is awesome. Like, that's excellent. When they get to, like, the snow mountain shootout, like, that whole sequence is great. And
oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, I mean,
I like the standard knock is, like, I can take it or leave it with the snow part.
No, that's, I think that's good, fun, cool. Like, I like, he kind of has this thing where he, like, everything's really, like, tactile, and I like the set design and the way things look, and, like, I don't know. I like those sequences. I could not really explain to you what's happening there at the end with, like, Marion Cotillard and the...
Sure, yeah.
You know, like, and frankly, I don't really... This movie works in a way where I don't feel like I need to, whereas Tenet didn't. But I guess I don't need to compare the two more. But... like I said, I still enjoy it all. So this one, I think, is definitely rewatchable. I would recommend it to anybody. Again, though, just to be a negative Nancy, the top spinning at the end, the final shot, is a total superfluous, useless choice. It changes nothing about the movie. No part of this movie was really about, you know, the movie does not change whether or not this is or isn't a dream. That was never established. That's not even... And interesting, I just think that's such a dumb guy thing
to
care about. I remember, like, I was maybe a freshman in high school when this came out. I remember discussions on the bus or whatever about, like, do you think it was a dream? And it's like, it doesn't matter. That's not, there's no answer. It doesn't change the movie. That, again, just like one step too far, you know?
See, I like that as an ending. Because I think Nolan completely would agree with you that it doesn't change the movie. It makes no difference. I like it when directors fuck with the audience in that way. Like, I'm going to, and that again is another kind of magic. Like, I'm going to make you look at this thing that doesn't matter while the thing that the whole movie has been driving towards, Cobb, Leonardo DiCaprio's character's reunion with his kids, is happening off camera. That's a level of like poking that I appreciate. I don't have any issue with the ending at all. It is what keeps this movie for me out of like the top of his work and out of the A range is there's just so much explanation and something I can't talk about Inception without mentioning how much I hate that Elliot Page's name in the movie is Ariadne.
Yeah.
I hate that so much. I hate that so much. That's on the level of calling John David Washington the protagonist in Tenet. It's so writerly. It just smacks of like being a placeholder that never was corrected in the final script. I hate that so much.
It feels like one of those things where you find out that that's the last name of some famous scientist who studied dreams. Like, that's like the type of dumb writer.
Yeah. That, yeah. You know. Not that, I mean, I had to look up what the source of that name after I saw the movie, but it certainly in watching the movie, it would have jumped out like, who the fuck is named Ariadne?
Yeah.
It must mean something. And oh, well, it turns out it means exactly what you would think it means as far as like Greek mythology is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Irritating.
I didn't know that's what it was, but that makes total sense. Yeah. I will say, though, I think they identify as he. Okay, yeah.
I say that like I know. I don't know.
If I'm wrong, I'm sorry. I believe it's he. I think he's good. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I think, is pretty good for an actor who I don't really care for. And I think Tom Hardy, it's like a total star-making performance for him. Like, he's really great. And Leo is like, you know, this is kind of the dumbest movie Leo has, like, maybe been in, you know, like, in a weird way.
That's totally fair, yeah.
And it's good. Like, he's good at that. And so I like the whole cast. I think it's good. And I recommend it's in my top three, so I like it.
Yeah, Ken Watanabe getting revenge for his nothing role in Batman Begins. He's also quite good. Everybody's, like, the whole cast is really invested in not so much the heist itself, but in, which probably lends a lot of credence to your various Reddit threads about, this wasn't a heist to get Cillian Murphy's character to sell his company at all. This was a heist to get Cobb back, whatever.
Yeah.
They're all just so happy for him at the very end. And I think that's, those kind of emotional stakes are what a movie is supposed to be built around instead of all this mythology and exposition.
Mm-hmm.
So like they can both exist with each other, but ultimately it's the emotional stakes that have to take greater precedence, which I think is the primary difference between this and Tenet.
Yeah.
Because there are just no emotional stakes in Tenet at all.
Yeah. I think you're right. I would also say, you know, just like one of my favorite kind of fun nitpicks of any movie ever is the idea that Leo's character is wanted for murder. And Ken Watanabe is just like, I just have to make one phone call, and by the time you live in America, you're good to go. It's like, what is that? And then, a classic one, too, is the, like, why didn't the kids just go to France or wherever, you know, like.
He seems to be living quite openly over there.
Yeah, it's like, it's a very strange, like, again, a very Christopher Nolan-esque construction of stakes to be like, oh, I can't see my kids unless I pull off this heist. And it's like, why don't the kids just come live with you? Like, it's, you know, whatever, but. It's again another one of those running Christopher Nolan, again, dead wife, and things like that. So it's got to, you know, I don't want to sound unfair, I guess, because I was pretty critical of the other movies for that. But I think if you watch Inception, you'll see it just works, you know, it's more fluid in the way the movie rolls. So I just like it much better.
And I would credit Marion Cotillard for making that dead wife character so alive in the segments of the movie where she shows up. Like, I remember being as terrified as Elliot Page's character when, like, she is, like, parting this crowd with, like, a knife, and she's about to stab Elliot Page in the middle of this dream. That is one of, like, the most striking shots in a Nolan movie for me. This guy who does this, like, giant spectacle type of stuff. Like, it's her with all of her poise, like just parting this crowd of whatever they call people and, like, whatever. I forget the vocabulary of Inception, but it would annoy me more if that performance wasn't so striking. You're number two. The tops of our list are quite similar.
Yeah, I was shocked. I was gonna say, I thought you might be a big Prestige guy. Like, I could see that being your number one.
It's the ending.
Yeah, and I also think, to your other point earlier, that I think the Prestige is the cool guy pick for Nolan. I think that's
probably true. Yeah,
but my number two, which I think is gonna be your number one, my number two is Dunkirk.
Okay, my number two is The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I figured we'd flip on those. So my number one
is Dark Knight. Therefore, your number one is The Dark Knight, so I'll talk about that one first.
So between Dark Knight and Dunkirk, Dark Knight is my favorite of the two, and my favorite of all these movies. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably, and I don't mean this, like, totally hyperbolic, I truly think it's the best blockbuster of the 21st century. I think what was that?
Oh, I didn't say anything.
Oh, I think I'm echoing. Sorry. Okay. I'll say that again. So I think it's the best blockbuster of the 21st century. And not just because it's a superhero movie and that's, like, the dominant, you know, genre of blockbusters in the world, you know, for the last decade. But I truly think, like, there is no better big budget, you know, big set piece action whatever thriller than this movie. Like, I truly love rewatching it. I remember seeing it in the theater when I was, like, probably 11 or 12 years old, blew my fucking mind when the truck flips.
Yeah.
That sequence is I don't know if there's a higher peak for an in theater moment from the last 21 years. So like, for me, that's the best part of this movie. And then of course you also get, of course, Heath Ledger giving like the great performance. I think it's the best Batman movie out of all of the Batman movies, which I'm a fan of Batman. I like that he took Batman, placed him in a real city with real stakes, and just made it a Michael Mann movie. Because
yeah, this is Heat. This movie is Heat.
And like, you could, you know, a shitty response to that would be like, that's derivative, and you know, Heat.
It was 2008. There's only so many stories to be told. I don't have a problem with like.
My other argument would be like, go watch any other superhero movie and tell me any of them that are as close to cool and fun as Heat. Because to me, that's a genius idea, to make Batman a Batman movie into Heat. I think that's great. So I like that. I like the Joker Batman dynamic. I think some would call it simple. I think it works. And I just think as a movie, it's eternally rewatchable for me. Sentimental, sure, because it was growing up probably my favorite movie. But overall, I fucking love watching it. And I know some people don't like some of the action in it. I don't understand that really. And I know there's some dumb plots to it. My argument would be like, it's a Batman movie, you know, it's a man dressed as a bat. Like,
sure. Yeah. You know?
But, overall, I just think it is a full on, just great thrill ride, reimagining of the genre, reimagining of the character. So I love it. It's my number one.
Yeah, a tremendously important movie, as far as for good and ill, as far as how it impacted superhero movies going forward, specifically like the DC brand of superhero movies and the Marvel movies in a way, like because the same summer this came out, Iron Man did as well, and you just have like this perfect illustration of how of the different ways you can take these kind of stories that are going to grow to dominate like the landscape, all this stuff with the Oscars, like, you know, this didn't receive Best Director or Best Picture in the following year. Now there are 10 Best Picture nominees, like in direct response to this, like the start, but certainly like, the most empowering movie for like the classic bad fan. Who possibly encouraged by that Oscar aftermath, like, oh, we actually have power to shape the world as far as what we want our movies to look like. But stripped of all that, it is probably the right way to think about making these kind of movies, in that you're not trying to imitate a previous superhero movie. You're trying to take a movie that you like, a movie that fits the tone of the whatever superhero you're adapting, and then make that movie.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to like, well, Iron Man did this in Iron Man 1, so I want Iron Man or whatever, some different, like, instead of like a house style, like leaving it up to the director.
Mm-hmm.
And like you see with Marvel, like Marvel has a house style to the point where they're like driving out directors who really want to do different things.
Yeah.
And like that's a lesson to take from the last like 15 years of superhero movies. And like Dark Knight provided another one.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's like a running like Twitter gag about like when these, especially it happens a lot with Marvel directors, but really most big budget directors in the last, you know, number of years in these studio systems, where like they're talking about the movie they're making, like Captain America, Civil War, or whatever. And they like, they'll reference like three, you know, like it's 3 Days of the Condor meets Parallax View meets the, and it's like, it's not. It never, no Marvel movie. It's all, they're all paint by numbers. They all look and feel identical. And Dark Knight is its own movie. Yes, it's the middle movie of a trilogy, but like, you don't need to see either of those other movies to care about the stakes of this movie, which is, again, something that is just entirely lost in the world today. Like, you cannot watch a single Marvel movie without being forced to think about like three other Marvel movies and the new Disney Plus show. And you should really look at this app that has a game where you meet this character. Like, that shit's terrible. Mm-hmm. And The Dark Knight is a standalone, you know, take, you know, if you've never read a Batman comic before, you'll like it. If you like Batman, you'll like it. You know, like, I think it works on every level as far as the, you know, blockbuster, comic book movie, and just a genre film. So I think it works across the board.
And it's like a serious considerate, like, because it doesn't take place in the real world, it can't, but it wants to at least consider what it would be like if something like this did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, people can quibble with, like, the morality plays in the very ending that very much seem like something you would talk about in, like, a philosophy class, like a bad philosophy class.
Yeah. Would you steal a loaf of bread to feed your family?
Exactly, yes, like that kind of shit. But I do think up to us, again, with the ending on these Nolan movies, mm-hmm. for the better chunk, it does take itself very seriously in a way that somebody like Zack Snyder, who also takes himself very seriously, is just not able to pull off.
Yes.
Like it's like him being essentially Nolan's successor with these like DC Comics movies. As much as we've said that Nolan can't like measure up to directors that he might want to, like Spielberg or like Kubrick, like Snyder can't measure up to an imitator of an imitator or like an imitation of an imitator. Like, people are still chasing this kind of movie and they just can't really get there.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like the movie itself, as opposed to like its considerable place in the culture, I think if you recast Heath Ledger with somebody else, or his performance wasn't as good, this would be like totally middle of the pack. They ask way too much of Christian Bale, I think, in this movie, especially Christian Bale with his Batman voice. I think you can't end this movie with him giving like a 5-minute monologue in his stupid Batman voice. It just really, for me, it just really doesn't work.
I think all that's true. But again, in comparison to Nolan's other movies, I think this is a good example where his talent as a director and all of the kind of role players within his world that help make his movies good. You know, like that last monologue, you're right. Like, he is doing the Batman voice. But you also get that great Batman score. And I really like the direction of that sequence and the look of the motorcycle and the cape. Like,
that, oh, yeah. The final, like, minute or so, I think, is good.
I think there are a number of sequences in the movie that, like, you're right. Like, if a lesser director stepped in, I would question them more. You know, but Christopher Nolan is so good at building tension, creating that feeling that something is about to happen, you know?
Yeah.
He does it when the mayor gets shot with, the 21-gun salute. I like the sequence with the two boats and when Batman is, like, taking down the hostages with the sonar or whatever. Like, I think all that's great. I think it looks cool when he does the, like, weird reverse parachute out of, like, China. Like, mm-hmm. all of that stuff, again, on paper, is kind of dumb. But the directing is just so good and watchable and gripping in the exact, like, that's exactly what you want from this type of movie, at least for me. So for me, it all, like, you know, again, like, you can make a lot of nitpicks, right? It is insane that Commissioner Gordon fakes his death.
That just makes no sense.
It is the dumbest. It is truly a dumb piece of plot. Like, it makes no sense.
That's a lie. Like, he's just lying to the audience. That's not a trick. Really, that's not a twist.
I've always said I want to watch the movie where Commissioner Gordon just goes on like a 2-week vacation to get away from his wife and the Joker, like, because he clearly just had enough of it, you know. But yeah. I will say, though, as dumb as that plot point is, I remember sitting in the theater cheering when he rips off the SWAT mask and reveals it, and I don't know why I cheered. Because it makes no sense.
Yeah, it's just animal brain cinematic magic.
but on like a, on like kind of the highest level. At least we, at least the highest level I think we've gotten for, you know, at least the last 20 years, you know. So I will always love it. You know, maybe I'm a little, you know, nostalgic, but I just think if, I think if you watch this movie and if you get too hung up on the plot, then you're just watching the movie wrong, frankly. But that's just me.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But I do think, I do think Heath Ledger accounts for like a full letter grade's worth of quality. I think when this is a Pucci situation where when he's not on screen, you're asking, where's the Joker?
Yes.
I remember watching this movie in theaters, and I didn't catch it the weekend of. I probably waited like a week or two for like crowds to die down. But by that point, I was just fully inundated with like, holy shit, he's amazing, he's amazing, he's amazing. It was all, he's going to win an Oscar. It's so tragic that he's gone after giving this fantastic performance. And then sitting in the theater is like, surely he can't be that good. And in fact, he is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and his, like his intro scene where he, where he's got the pencil trick and the grenades and the I'm not crazy. And he's just, he's making choice after choice after choice. And everyone is the right one somehow. Like the total package is this truly indelible character, and I feel like inarguably one of the best villains that's ever been on screen.
Definitely,
he's just surrounded by Maggie Gyllenhaal is kind of like phoning it in, and whatever's going on with the commissioner. Gordon and his fake death, and like,
I'll
if say, it's not directly related to the Joker, the movie's just not working for as well.
I kind of like the deep, like I like the like deep bench of like I think like it's kind of nuts that like Morgan Freeman and now I'm blanking on who plays Commissioner Gordon.
Gary Oldman.
Like, I kind of think it's, and Michael Caine, like, it's kind of crazy that they're like the fourth, fifth, and sixth lead in this movie. You know, like,
yeah.
I think it kind of works. And I think like Aaron Eckhart, who is like a totally forgettable actor, you know, is actually pretty good for kind of a strange role that like we talked about with Cillian Murphy. I think Two-Face in this movie works better as kind of a more believable villain, I guess, like a more believable performance. Whereas like, it, a couple years earlier, it might've been a bit more hokey, closer to like Tommy Lee Jones's like crazy, you know, Two-Face, but
it is quite hokey. Like the level of effects on his face. It's gross,
mm-hmm.
correctly gross. A little unclear how he's like keeping all of his organs in his head.
Yeah, I'm no medical professional. So
sure. Yeah, and I'm nitpicking.
But yeah,
myself
I think that's fair. But it, for me, at least, like, I don't know, the moment where the kind of, again, like where he's tied up and Rachel's tied up and he's on the floor with the gasoline, like, I think that's a really well directed sequence that like kind of delivers Two-Face as a character more, whereas like another movie, a worse version of the movie would just present this kind of hokey villain that like I don't would never buy into, but you know, here or there. Sure. I guess.
And like that's the only thread that carries over to Dark Knight Rises is like the myth of Harvey Dent.
Yes.
Which I might like Dark Knight Rises better if that character left off the screen more for me. Mm. I remember just not being too terribly invested in that myth, so that when it is overturned in Dark Knight Rises, you're like, oh, whatever, just blow up a football stadium, Bane, everything's fine.
Yeah, no, I think I do think, to get back to your original point, you're right that like obviously the Joker is the best part of the movie, you know, so it's of course like, you know, again, when Aaron Eckhart and Gary Oldman and Morgan Freeman all get to be, you know, role players behind that level of performance, I'm okay with, you know, watching Maggie Gyllenhaal, you know, like, because I also get to watch Heath Ledger, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, again, like you said, I think it's one of the great character introductions in all of movies, is that scene with the pencil, like, that's amazing. And I think you're right. I think it's one of the great villains in movie history, which is, again, saying a lot, you know.
Yeah. And even like the hand-to-hand combat stuff that Nolan is not good at. I can think of like two instances in the whole movie where it's even a thing.
Yeah.
Good and right. This is more like car chases.
Yeah, it's like the car chase sequence is great. I like when he's like grappling around and like tying up the hostages. Like, I think that's cool. And I think that sequence is good. I like kind of all, I'm not as big, it's not as big a detractor for me, but I totally understand if someone, you know, if they're looking for more of that action in the movie, you're right. It's, you know, that's not his strong suit.
Yeah. And like, the last thing to say about The Dark Knight before we move on to Dunkirk is like my favorite thing to do in movies is like, what does this have to say about contemporary politics? Like the NSA type spy stuff. Like that's just a perfect example of it's a perfect example of how these systems are so often presented to mass markets. Like, we have this incredible tool that is like nakedly on its face dangerous and unconstitutional and a threat to people everywhere. But as long as it's in the right hands, everything's okay.
Well, I hear this complaint often. I would push back. Morgan Freeman does voice those concerns. And at the end of the movie, he destroys the device because he says, we can't, you know, you shouldn't have this power.
Sure, but, yes.
And that goes down to Batman, you know, you can go down the Batman rabbit hole, or Batcave, I should say, of like, you know, he's a billionaire using tech to like be a vigilante, to like beat up the homeless of Gotham, you know,
like and the mentally ill,
beating a Batman that is this like this insane, you know, in The Dark Knight. Like, there's a tweet recently, and you can cut this out maybe, I don't know, but there's a tweet recently where Ben Shapiro mentioned, like, in the New York mayoral race, that like when asked like what's one thing if you were elected tomorrow you would make illegal, they all answered, you know, whatever, and Ben Shapiro tweeted like, notably, nobody mentioned crime. And then someone quote tweeted that and said, like, what did he want them to, like, enact the Dent Act? Which is, like, that is the, you know, as political as this movie gets, is, like, Harvey Dent wants to outlaw criminals, you know? Like, So it is, like, I try to not read too heavy into...
And that's something we haven't talked about yet, really, is, like, he has... I don't necessarily... agree, but he does have like a surface level interpretation of being like a conservative filmmaker, based on I don't know, I guess like the chaos of the French Revolution-esque trials and Dark Knight Rises and like the Eat the Rich stuff.
We didn't talk about that in Dark Knight Rises, but that is a total miscue. Is just the like. It seemed like a pretty immediate response to like Occupy Wall Street as like a zeitgeist, and I don't think the movie has much of a point of view.
There's nothing there.
Yeah, it's really nothing there, which is again like a fault. Like, it's just bad.
It's all at the behest of someone who's just going to blow everybody up anyway. There's just nothing to be said about it. It's a cool. Idea that just has no follow through at all. Yeah. And there's some of that in The Dark Knight too, I think, with like, well, it's more of like a liberal tenet that like humans are, like people are basically good, even the ones that are cast as Tiny Lister to look as threatening as Tiny Lister. Is that his name?
Which role is that?
Something Lister. The inmate who throws the bomb remote away. I can't remember what his name is. He's Debo in Friday.
But I love that casting. I think that guy is
perfect. It's so on the nose.
Yeah. I like it. I like that guy's like whole thing in the movie. He's like a real heat check, like when he's on screen, I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like Tenet is this like climate change parable.
Yeah.
On its surface, like, yeah, I was gonna say if you drill deep down, but like, no, that's not the case at all. It's on the surface, as is Interstellar. I don't think it's warranted, but people, these movies just become so big that people do want to talk about them in whatever way they possibly can, and like have all the takes and all that. And like, he gives them ammunition, no question. He's just not. His interest is so clearly more in the spectacle. than like the and than any kind of like thematic meat.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Again, if you're watching your Batman movie for, I don't know, some ideological nuance, like grow up and read a book. I don't know.
Yeah, that's all fair. So the last movie is Dunkirk. This is my number one of his movies. I think it's just, it's the simplest. It's the simplest one of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks to an alternate career where he, and it, not to say that Dunkirk is a simple movie, it is time-lapsed. It is like taking place in three different timelines. A fact that I never even considered while I was watching it. I was just letting this movie happen. And it didn't, when it had to be explained to me like a week or so later about how it takes, you know, like an hour to fly across with a plane, the English Channel. It takes whatever. I don't need to go into it.
A day with the boat, a week on the beach. Yeah.
Yes. It didn't add anything to the movie, and it didn't take away anything for the movie. Like, there's just there's an urgency and attention to Dunkirk that is sustained the entire way through.
Exactly. That
overpowers any kind of critical thinking in a way that, in talking earlier about magic tricks, like in the way that it makes you feel like what it would have been like to be a British soldier on the beach in Dunkirk in 1940. And having no idea what the next day was going to look like.
Yeah.
Or the next hour or whatever. Like, this is just a pure time travel experiment that completely works.
It's, I really, upon rewatch, like, it's, I think part of it is it just came out in a really good movie year. Like, 2017 was at least for me, really great year of movies. And I think it kind of got maybe a bit forgotten in that. But it is a real, like, really great movie, just like you're saying, like, just a technical masterpiece of, like, building tension, creating, you know, this ambiance and feeling, and doing it without dialogue, and doing it purely through, like, editing and score. It really, like, just delivers, like, perfectly. And, you know, the day, hour, week thing, you know, conceit, like, I could take it or leave it. I kind of like that he did it because I, you know, there's something truthful in it, I guess. But when I was watching the movie the first time, I didn't realize it really. And again, didn't really change my viewing experience.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah. I haven't rewatched this movie. I would be curious to.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because it's a very good movie, but just because would I take anything extra from that time stuff? I really don't think I would, which on the one hand, if I was being uncharitable, would overcomplicate what is a very straightforward narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I don't know, like it was in like a sense of historical accuracy, like it was a multi-pronged effort.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to, you know, capture the broadest scope possible while still maintaining that extreme focus.
Yes.
I think he does it.
Yeah, it's a way of taking the three storylines and putting them all in a fishbowl, right? And like he has to construct some narrative device to do that. But again, you can just watch the movie and enjoy. Like there, as I was rewatching it, like the dogfight sequences are just amazing. Like really, the best. I don't. There maybe are some earlier films I've never seen that depict dogfighting, but this has to be the best. Like, it's so good. Multiple different, you know, really just phenomenal. Like, when they're running the stretcher across the bridge to catch the boat in time, or when the boat's sinking and they have to escape. Like, there are so many just, like, pressure cooker scenes, sequences that just all string together. You know, always, there's always momentum behind it. It really is watchable and enjoyable and just like high level filmmaking. Probably like, honestly, if I'm really being honest with myself, like this is his most well-made film, right? This like that easily should be number one probably. I just enjoy Dark Knight, you know, as a popcorn flick more. But like we talked about 1917 like months ago, and you really liked it.
I prefer that movie to this movie.
So I would say if you rewatch Dunkirk, I think Dunkirk accomplishes everything that 1917 tries to accomplish, but it does it in a far less preachy way, and it does it just through, like, you know, less gimmicky filmmaking. Because I, you know, the one take thing, whatever. But I think Dunkirk delivers exactly what 1917 was doing, but I think it does it better. So that's that. But, like, overall, I just think, as far as, like, a war movie goes, and these ideas about, like, individual sacrifice and being one of many out there on the, you know, it does it without having to spoon feed it to you. And we talk a lot about, with all of these movies with Nolan, like, he really likes to add in these extra ideas or go this one step too far or whatever. And he, I don't know how, I don't know if it was just the subject matter that he just took serious or whatever, but he reels it in for this one movie and really delivers. So I, Dunkirk, I would be interested to hear what Shane thinks, because you were saying he was just about to watch it. I think it is his maybe technically best film.
Yeah, as far as, like, where it lands in, like, the pantheon of war movies, you take something out of each one of them. I wouldn't necessarily. I'd have to think a little deeper about if this was the first time I had really observed this specific kind of thing, this specific kind of idea in a war movie. But just, like, the opening scene of Dunkirk. Two things: the opening scene of Dunkirk, where it's the I wouldn't say the lead, but the guy that we're following on the beach, Fionn Whitehead's character, he survives purely by accident. He's with his squad and they're just being picked off one by one. They're not doing anything different than he is. He's not smarter, he's not faster. It's just pure randomness that he happens to get to the place with that provides a little bit of cover. So that's one, just the idea that and like that he's still fairly, and he's not fantastically well known or anything, but he certainly wasn't in 2017. So it the equivalent would be like Tom Hanks dying on the beach in Normandy. Like he survives that because he's Tom Hanks and because the movie is about him in a certain way. But in another more accurate way, everybody thought they were going to be the one to, like, survive and ride to Berlin, and some amount of people were not.
Yeah.
And
no, it's
the way that Nolan's choice to start the movie with that gives a level of randomness that continues throughout the movie. Like, you see it in just a totally ignominious way that Barry Keoghan's character dies on the boat with Mark Rylance. Like, he was taking heroic steps in his life, but he died unheroically.
Yes.
And no, then the other thing,
like
Fionn Whitehead's character, like, obviously his first priority is to stay alive, but for much of that first half an hour, however long, his secondary priority is just to find a place to take a shit.
It is a great, you really have to take a shit movie. It's pantheon Mount Rushmore, the feeling of I really have to take a shit and I can't.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like Dunkirk, Dumb and Dumber, and two more. I can't, nothing comes to mind off the top of my head.
Is it really? Yeah. American Pie, of course.
Definitely those two. Yeah.
can't you picture Finch's head on Mount Rushmore?
Oh yeah, that's fair. Yeah, we'll give two spots to American Pie. Just get Jennifer Coolidge's head up there too. Her head should be in more places as a statue. Something I've never been able to figure out about Dunkirk. Why did Tom Hardy have to crash his plane in enemy territory? He, like, flew over all of those English soldiers. It's a big deal in the movie that he, like, is allowing himself to be taken prisoner.
Yes.
I think that's my one quibble with Dunkirk. Yeah. I've been quibbling a lot. Like, Nolan movies just invite that kind of quibbling. But it's like this big emotional moment with one of the better shots from the movie, of, like, him standing in front of the burning plane at dusk. And I just never understood the logistics of it.
I believe it's got to be something about the speed with which he was coming in that he could not.
I guess.
I don't remember exactly. But, yeah, that's an example of a moment where, you know, despite, you're right, like, that is a perfectly fine thing to question when you're watching the movie. But despite that, the moment is still very triumphant.
Like,
you feel it in your guts, you know, in that moment. Or like we were talking about before, like, the, you know, on paper, if you told me that part of this movie, a third of this movie, was going to be Mark Rylance and two boys on a boat just sailing across the channel, like, that does not sound exciting. But somehow he really delivers on making that those sequences, you know, flow with the movie and stay engaging, you know. And then when they show up on the beach with all the boats and, like, Kenneth delivers, like, the cheesiest line ever, you're fucking fist pumping, even though I'm not a Brit. Like, I fucking loved it. Like, so he really knows how to just, like, deliver those moments. And Dunkirk has, you know, a couple of them.
Yeah. Weirdly, like, Dunkirk falls into this pattern of, and this is the last thing we'll say about it. Dunkirk falls in this pattern of, like, coincidental release schedule, where it was like one of three movies about Dunkirk in 2017. It was this and Darkest Hour and Their Finest, which was, you know, one is about, like, the propaganda effort and one is about the actual fighting of the battle and one is about Winston Churchill. But it's just that's always funny to me when that happens. I, like, Dunkirk is clearly the winner just because it convey has the most urgency to it, and it has like an on the ground feel that the other two, for obvious reasons, don't have. But just clear winner. Like, this is the movie that's gonna survive.
Yeah, and
the other two are just gonna fall by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing to say about Nolan in general is that, like, he places such primacy on the theater experience. The only one of these movies that I saw in, like, the proper format that he wanted, like an IMAX 70mm or whatever, was Dunkirk. And I don't know, that never really does that much for me. I've only ever seen, like, one or two movies in 3D. It's like Life of Pi and something else, maybe. I don't know. Just tell me the story, and I'm okay, and I'm doing good.
Yeah.
And maybe that just, like, dead part of my cinematic brain, some level of immunity to spectacle, some level of I'll pay $8 for my ticket instead of, like, $25, and I'll be happy. Maybe that is part of why Nolan is this, like, second tier director for me.
Mm.
So I'm like, do you tend to go to, like, IMAX movies that kind of appreciation?
Yeah, I talked about it some, but it was pretty formative for me, like, growing up, like, summer blockbuster film. When you say those words, it's Dark Knight, it's Inception, it's Interstellar. I like the spectacle, especially in a theater. Over the summer, I've returned to going to movie theaters.
Sure.
Local Atlanta theater, The Plaza, has been showing, like, 35mm Steven Spielberg. Like, I saw Raiders, I saw Jaws, two favorites. And, like, I maybe not as, like, enchanted as, like, the, like, Oscar montage of stuff going to the movies. But, like, I do think certain movies are just better in the theater. And so, like, I will always remember seeing Dark Knight. Like, I will always remember. I will always remember seeing Inception. And so, like, for me, I have those memories because those were my teenage summer blockbusters. So I really like them. I think if Tenet had released in a theater, like, you know, and if I had seen it in a theater, I mean, you know, maybe my review would have been a little more positive because I would have just been like, you know what, the car chase looked better on a big screen, but I didn't see it that way. So for me, like, I, in general, if he's releasing a movie, I will go see it in a theater. I guess I'd pay the extra money for the IMAX, but I like you, I kind of, you know, it's already on a big screen and it's already pretty loud.
Yeah.
Like, I don't always think that. Unless I have noticed this before, unless it's filmed for IMAX, which he does, I remember seeing the opening sequence of Dark Knight Rises, which they, like, teased at, like, an IMAX, you know, screening before some movie, I can't even remember, but, like, you know, the sequences he films for IMAX, specifically, like, that one, are worth the cost, I guess, you know.
Yeah, Yeah, there's some kind of like there's all kinds of different IMAX, and there's like fake IMAX and real IMAX and real IMAX. I don't follow any of that shit. Like to see Dunkirk in the proper IMAX screening, I had to drive all the way out to like the Buford Mall of Georgia twice because the first time the projector was broken. So I was already pretty irritated by the time I finally got to sit down in the theater. I mean, Dunkirk is a great movie, but I would have felt the exact same way if I had seen it in like the local art theater in Atlanta at the time. That's just not, I like the greatest like theater going experiences for me, as far as like spectacle, like just local central Indiana, Mad Max Fury Road, like seeing that on opening night, like, yeah, that would be up there. And there wasn't anything special about the screening. I just don't have that kind of, that kind of like technical appreciation.
Yeah.
And it might just be as simple as like being just totally overwhelmed by the size of the screen. Like I can't imagine sitting in like in the first like 10 rows of an IMAX screen. Like I feel like I would miss just like a huge amount of action, but some people just really love that, just to be totally immersed and to just to be, as I said, like overwhelmed by the picture.
Yeah. I think that would be maybe a good podcast down the line. It's like, what was your best theater experience? What's the one movie that you wish you could see in a theater? Like, I always like thinking about that kind of stuff. So,
yeah. Speaking of future podcasts, we'll have another one of our regular episodes coming up in the next couple weeks to discuss our latest trio of movies. And this month, we'll be discussing Captain Fantastic and Spotlight and Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar in advance of The Many Saints of Newark release in October, The Sopranos prequel. Long-awaited return to screens of David Chase. We're going to do several episodes about The Sopranos. Certainly a formative TV experience for myself, and I can speak for Shane as well, one for him. We haven't exactly landed on a format for that just yet, but we're certainly not going to go episode by episode. We don't have time, and as we have with many other TV series, we would surely run out of steam long before we finished. So what we'll probably do is we'll probably just pick a few topics that are visited upon in Sopranos, like the capital F family, the lowercase family. I want to talk about like the bad episodes of Sopranos as well, so probably do an episode dedicated to, say, Vito in New Hampshire and Massive Genius and like those kind of episodes, and like Italian American discrimination that'll be fun to talk about. We'll be doing those over the course of the next several weeks. In the meantime, you can check out reviews for some of these movies, Tenet especially, but I think I've got a review of Dunkirk on the website as well. MunichMovie.club is where you can find those. You can like us on Facebook at Munich Movie Club, follow us on Twitter at Munich Movie Club, and we're on Instagram at Munich Movie Club as well. Thank you for joining me tonight, Pierce.
Of course, anytime.
Yeah, Paul Thomas Anderson has a movie coming out in the fall or the winter, so I feel like that's a strong candidate for our next director ranking.
Definitely. Unless
something else comes up in the meantime.
We should definitely keep this going. I like this. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the proper like this is a long podcast certainly, but like a 10 like a total filmography no bigger than like 10 or 12 movies, I think is the right number. Mm-hmm. Paul Thomas Anderson will fit right nicely in there.
Right. We're basically cramming like a whole season of Blank Check into 2 hours. So
pretty much, yes. And because I'm very behind on podcasts, I'm right in the middle of like the Nolan episodes that they did.
Yeah.
I'm steeped in Nolan these days. But as far as the Munich Movie Club is concerned, no more. And again, as I was saying, I hope I never have to think about Tenet again for the rest of my life. Have a good night, Pierce.
All right, you too.
All right. Okay, that's a 1 hour and 45 minute podcast.